Hi, and welcome to this weekend edition of Radio Prague, the international service of Czech radio. I'm Christian Falvey. Many thanks for tuning in. Starting off an excellent program for today, David Vaughan reunites with writer and translator Paul Wilson, who's back in Prague with a new book. After that, we get a look at the lighter side of the news and magazine, and later on in our program, another trip through the Czech radio archives. All that ahead, so please stay tuned. Any history of Czechoslovakia's dissident movement in the 1970s will include more than a passing reference to the writer, editor, and translator Paul Wilson. Originally from Canada, he came to the country in 1967, then in his 20s, and he was to stay for 10 years, eventually expelled in 1977 for associating with dissidents and the underground music scene. Paul Wilson was back in Prague last month for the launch of a collection of his essays about the country over the last three decades. He spoke to David Vaughan.
During the decade he spent in Czechoslovakia, Paul Wilson was far more than just an observer. After witnessing the Prague Spring and the Soviet invasion of 1968, he became increasingly involved in the dissident movement during the political, social and cultural clampdown of the 70s. His friends included not just writers and thinkers, among them Václav Havel, but also musicians, and he ended up playing with the legendary underground rock band The Plastic People of the Universe. After his expulsion and return to Canada, Paul continued to promote the work of dissident writers and musicians, helping to draw attention in the West to their plight. And he writes frequently about the Czech Republic to this day. A Czech edition of Paul's essays has just been published and was launched with the surviving members of the Plastic People in attendance at the Václav Havel Library here in Prague. And that was where I met him.
It's rather nice that your book's being launched here at the Václav Havel Library. Do you have a particular memory of Václav Havel?
I do have a very vivid memory of the last time I talked to him, which was last March, that is March 2011, when I was on my way to Egypt to find out just how much like 1989 or how much unlike 1989 the revolution was. And I took along some of my translations, especially The Power of the Powerless and other essays. And I asked him if I could have his permission to find a translator into Arabic, because I thought maybe the Arabs might be able to use an essay like The Power of the Powerless. And he said, yes, please, go ahead. But then he said, but listen, Paul, he said, do you think the Arabs are ready for democracy? And I said, Vašku, do you think the Czechs are ready for democracy in 89? Nobody's really ready for it, you know, especially when things happen so quickly. So that was the last time I actually talked to him directly. And then I was at his funeral, of course, which was a sad thing, but also quite inspiring because of the upwelling of feeling that people expressed.
And I have to follow up that question with the obvious question. You say you went to Egypt to see if there were parallels with what you remembered of the Velvet Revolution here. How many did you find?
Well, I found a few. I don't know how profound or superficial they were, but the idea that suddenly fear disappears overnight, that definitely happened. And the incredible sense of empowerment that people felt because they had brought this dictator down was even stronger, in fact, because they actually did have a direct influence on the fall of Mubarak. But there were all so many differences that I think the parallels that people were drawing, these sort of facile parallels, did not apply. And I think now they're going through a pretty difficult stage. We'll see how it turns out. But my fingers are crossed for them.
As long as it doesn't end up like 68.
There's no one to invade them. They can only screw it up themselves.
And we're here in the Václav Havel Library for the launch of your book, which has the very corny title of Bohemian Rhapsodies. Why is it called Bohemian Rhapsodies?
Well, we were looking around for a title that kind of expressed the spirit of what was in the book and couldn't find any. And I thought that it would be interesting to have a title that would be recognizable even to people who didn't understand English. You call it corny, I call it ironic. There are no rhapsodies in the book. Some of the pieces I think are quite critical of some of the politics that go on here.
Yeah, when I said corny, maybe I should stress that I meant there's clearly an element of tongue-in-cheek.
Oh, there's definitely an element of tongue-in-cheek, and there's an even bigger one. because Ivan Jiros, who is the fabled, now passed away, artistic director of the Plastic People of the Universe and the godfather of the underground, I don't know how else I could describe him. Ivan Jiros hated Queen, and Ivan had very, very strict musical taste, and he actually, according to some young people that I talked to, people who were young then, he forbade them to listen to Queen.
And so you're being very mean, because of course he can't answer back now, now that you've called this book Bohemian Rhapsodies. Now that he's no longer with us.
He can't answer back, but I am prepared to defend it before him, before whichever throne we stand.
And tell me, what did you decide to put in this collection of essays that you have written over the years about Czechoslovakia, about the Czech Republic? I mean, Czechs are notorious for being very, very sceptical about foreigners who write about them, and of course you're exposing yourself to being torn apart.
Well, exactly, and I'm actually looking forward to it, because I gave Viktor Stoyalov, the publisher at Torst, a collection of essays, most of which were about Czechoslovakia, but some of which were about other subjects as well, music and philosophy, Marshall McLuhan, all kinds of different subjects. But Martin Machovec, the editor, chose only Czech subjects. And he kept reassuring me that people would find it interesting and so on. But, I mean, if I'm exposed to public tearing down, I don't mind. The pieces were written over the past 30 years, and I feel a certain sense of distance from them. And I won't take it personally if people hate them.
And so can you give us some examples of pieces that are in the collection, for example, from that period 30 years ago when there was no light at the end of the tunnel as far as communist Czechoslovakia was concerned?
Well, the piece that leads off is a piece called Growing Up with Orwell, and it's really a piece about reading Orwell at various stages of my life, but the most important stage, of course, was when I came to Czechoslovakia, so it's kind of autobiographical, describing how I arrived here and the Orwellian things that I saw around me or didn't see around me.
And you arrived as a very young man in 1967, wasn't it?
I was in my mid-20s in 1967, and I had just abandoned a master's thesis on George Orwell and decided to kind of strike out and see Orwellian territory for myself.
In the fall of 1967, the signals were very mixed. There were student demonstrations followed by crackdowns. People told me that there was more freedom of expression than before, but then suddenly a popular magazine would be banned. Wherever I went, though, people seemed happy, or at least expectant. They told me horror stories, but the stories all seemed to refer to the past. Hope had begun to cast its glow everywhere. It was as though the natural optimistic exuberance of the young people I taught in Brno and Prague had infected the whole of society. Whatever was going on, it did not feel like 1984. Oddly enough, though, the visible features of 1984 were almost all there. The elevators that didn't work, the drab clothing, the dismal public art, the chronic shortages of basic goods like toilet paper and potatoes, the rot-gut local rum, the cold, filthy trains and crowded trams, the dimly lit streets, the vile cigarettes that spilled their tobacco whenever they were tipped vertically, the banners and the signs flaunting boilerplate slogans that celebrated the gains of socialism. In the prevailing optimism, however, such things seemed like temporary inconveniences to be borne with sporting good humor until things got better. I didn't understand that they were not symptoms of a disease, but the disease itself, nor did I appreciate the grinding humiliations of everyday life, which were largely invisible to me.
Another piece, which I wrote in the early 80s about the plastic people. That was partly because they were still in terrible trouble with the police, and I wanted to give them some kind of profile abroad, and that was published in a big magazine called Musician. And then there are book reviews, and there are essays on translation, and a series of essays I wrote for the New York Review of Books on the elections of 92 and the breakup of the country. And there's a lot about Havel, because people ask me to write about him, and so I have tried to be fair, but with a certain distance, and some of the essays about him are fairly critical, I would say.
It's just a few months after his death, of course, there's a danger of hagiography, isn't there?
Well, there is, and I don't think there's any hagiography in my pieces. When I look back at them, especially when I read them in Czech, I think the only fault may be that they're too kind. Not that I don't admire the man, but, I have a certain distance from him, even though I have a very intimate knowledge of his work as his translator.
There's evidently a great deal you do agree with in Havel. So what are some particular points that niggle with you?
What niggles with me is his rejection of political parties, something he may have inherited from Masaryk, and he also may have inherited, as the Czechs say, an allergy against political parties, against big political parties, because of the Communist Party.
Do you think that the alternative is sort of intrigue and a lack of clarity on the political scene? That's what you think is the danger?
I think that distancing himself from being involved in party politics himself weakened him in his negotiations with Parliament when he tried to get, quite rightly, certain laws passed or certain changes made to the Constitution. He had no negotiating power because he had no party behind him. It left him quite helpless sometimes vis-à-vis Václav Klaus.
You've mentioned differences with President Havel. What would be in his ideas, maybe the idea that comes closest to your own view of the world?
I think it's this incredible capacity that Havel had within him to forgive people who ask for forgiveness. In other words, you know, he did not hold it against communists who were sincerely willing to drop their communism and take part in the creation of a new democratic state. He was completely willing to forgive. That willingness not to carry old conflicts into the future is an amazing quality. But I think even deeper than that is his quality of decency. He treated people decently. He treated the secret policemen who were tailing him, he treated them decently.
Going out and offering them cups of tea and things like that when they were watching his country cottage, that sort of thing.
That's right, and helping them out of the ditch when they got stuck in the snow and letting them know where he was going in advance. He was kind to them in a very strange way. He couldn't hold grudges, and I think that sense of his presence really had an impact, especially on his immediate circle, but even on people beyond that.
And finally, Josef Škvorecký, who was the most famous Czech in Canada, where you are from, died recently. A few years ago, Professor Gordon Skilling died, who was the foremost North American historian of 20th century Czechoslovakia. Do you feel a growing sense of responsibility on your own shoulders to inform your compatriots about this country, about the Czech Republic and Czechoslovakia, and it's been in the 20th and now the 21st century?
I don't necessarily feel a growing sense of responsibility, because this book, this collection of essays, is an example of what I've been doing over the years, and just in those very terms, informing Canadians and Americans and the Brits about what was going on here. But the fact is that both Škvorecký and Skilling leave a huge hole behind them. Although both of them, and Havel as well, and even Ivan Jiros, who also passed away recently, have left behind them what I would call a completed work. They did not die not having fulfilled their destiny as writers or as politicians or whatever they wanted to be. And so the only obligation that I feel, especially in terms of Škvorecký, is there might be some of his books that may need translating, and certainly I think I would like to work on raising Ivan Jiros' profile, because he was very important in this country, more important than a lot of people know.
Very hard to translate into English, mind you.
It is, but I mean, his story about the plastic people is pretty straightforward, and I started translating in the 1970s by translating his essays.
Paul Wilson, thank you very much indeed for talking to us, and best of luck with the Czech collection of your essays, Bohemian Rhapsodies.
Thanks, David.
David Vaughan there talking to Paul Wilson. This is Radio Prague. And up next on our program, Daniela Lazarova has a compendium of the latest weird and wonderful news. Here's this edition of Magazine.
It was one of Central Europe's major curiosities, a football field cut in half by the Czech-Austrian border. The field, located in the vicinity of Leopoldschlag in Austria and Dolní Dvořiště in the Czech Republic, hosted local football competitions. A player kicked the ball from one corner in the Czech Republic to the midfielder in Austria. The benches for spectators were also partly on Czech, partly on Austrian territory. What happened was that in 1973, changes were made to the basin of the River Malše, which formed a natural border line, and the basin was moved deeper into Czech territory. The two countries' governments agreed that once this was done, they would sign an agreement on a small change to the common border. However, the agreement was forgotten in time, and the Leopoldschlag football club, which needed a new site for a football field, built it on the empty plot of land which was formerly the Malše riverbed. Although technically they were partly on Czech territory, nobody complained, and the football field was put to good use. During the communist years, Austrian spectators to football games moved illegally across the Iron Curtain as they went from one end of the field to the other. Players played on the territory of two states, elsewhere separated by barbed wire. But these were technicalities. In practice, the border guards were on the other side of the river and did not attempt to interfere. It was only when the ball was kicked over the river that one of us would experience 10 minutes of fear as they went over to get it, a player recalled later. We would see there were armed border guards patrolling the opposite side of the river bank, but nothing ever happened. They never made a move against us. After the fall of communism, getting a lost ball back was no longer such an adventure. But it was not until 20 years later that the two countries moved to remedy the situation. The Czech Republic ceded that small part of territory to Austria, and Central Europe lost another curiosity. CSSR, the abbreviation of Communist Czechoslovakia, or to be precise, the Czechoslovak Socialist Republic as it was known, has come back to life as the name of a new party that Czech farmers are now setting up. The party is to be registered as Česká strana selského rozumu, meaning the Czech Party of Common Sense. Clearly, they're hoping to attract party members and voters with an attribute that appears to be scarce in Czech politics these days. The controversial art group Stohoven made headlines once again when, on the day of a parliament session at which an MP defended himself against the corruption charges levied against him, they managed to violate an SMS gateway and send ministers, MPs and even President Klaus fake SMS messages, which appeared to have been sent by their colleagues and political rivals. MPs thus received messages from their party leaders inviting them to attend a session on moral reform, and messages from rivals saying, "We have both behaved shamefully. I entreat you to be there." A communist MP said he had received a message saying, "There are funny things going on upstairs. Who is taking care of it?" from a colleague, and President Klaus received one from his close aide saying, "You have done much harm with your rhetoric. Enough of your stubborn demagogy. Please attend the session on moral reform." It must be said that most politicians took the joke with good grace and even smiled for the cameras as they read out their own message to journalists. Ludovít Bary, an artist who specializes in violin making, wood carving and painting, is showing a collection of his work at Emmausi Cloister in Prague. Among them are 20 fantastic-looking violins, which are as beautiful to the eye as they are to the ear. Bary learned the art of violin making on his own, and his unique pieces are inspired by nature, the female body, the wings of a fly, and even Star Trek. Occasionally they're used by the Talich Quartet, but none of them are for sale, and Bary has even resisted an offer from Vanessa May. He does sell his wood carvings and paintings, though, and there is considerable interest in his works. You can see some of his creations in a book called Works Created by Love, written by the artist himself. Czech troops serving in Afghanistan were in for a pleasant surprise from the Army Chief of Staff, General Vlastimil Pik, earlier this month. The general arrived at their base in Logar with a visitor, chef and TV personality Yuri Babica, whose job it was to cheer up the troops with a few specialties from home. Despite an initial security scare when the chef was rushed to a bomb shelter in a Taliban attack, the barbecue was a huge success. Babica said later that although he had pulled all the stops with his grilled specialties, the troops were more delighted with two basic products they really missed from home, Czech bread and Czech mustard. The inhabitants of Děčín are taking the local library by storm. Instead of the usual two or three books people borrow, they are now coming in for 10 or 20. The reason is not a mass conversion to books as a sole source of entertainment and information, but a generous response to an appeal from the local library, which is moving house over the summer and has limited capacities with which to transport over 2,000 publications. It has therefore appealed to the public to take out as many books as they can over the summer and return them to the new library in the autumn. Someone calculated that if every inhabitant of Děčín were to borrow 57 books, the library would empty out and the librarians could just walk over to the new building and wait for the shelves to fill. Finally, Roman Tietz, the controversial artist who recently served a month-long jail sentence for defacing 50 traffic lights in Prague, is back in the headlines. The artist swapped the lights for his own creations, showing the standard red and green figures drinking, urinating, being hanged or walking a dog. The Amoya Gallery in Prague is now showing some of those glass coverings as art and is even negotiating with different town halls as to whether they could not be installed legally. So far, the negotiations in the Czech capital have been unsuccessful, despite the fact that many of the city's inhabitants would welcome livelier images than the standard stationary and walking figures. Officials have suggested the possibility of showing them in parks or public places where they would not be functional as traffic lights, but the artist would prefer to see them in their proper environment. The gallery says that if all else fails, it would contact smaller towns to see if they're not more liberal in the matter.
Many thanks to Daniela Lazarova. Now, as ever of a Saturday, it's time for another trip down memory lane, or rather through the halls of the Czech radio archives. Here's David Vaughan.
You may remember that last year I played some archive recordings from the huge pre-war gatherings of the Sokol movement, bringing together tens of thousands of people in displays of mass gymnastics in an atmosphere of patriotic fervour. After the war, the communists suppressed the Sokol movement as part of the old political order, instead staging their own spectacular calisthenics displays in honour of the Communist Party. The first so-called Spartakiada, named after the Spartacus uprising of slaves in ancient Rome, was held in 1955 to mark the 10th anniversary of Czechoslovakia's liberation by the Red Army. 1 million gymnasts took part, with a total audience of 2 million. Among the guests was the French artist Fernand Léger, who was enchanted by the whole thing, telling Czechoslovak radio, "My God, I have found a land of people well fed and full of joy." The Spartakiada was then held every 5 years, with the exception of 1970, when it was cancelled amidst fears of protests against the Soviet-led invasion 2 years earlier. By 1980, the regime had firmly reasserted its authority, and the Spartakiada in July of that year was once again on a grand scale. Choreographed to the last detail, it opened with a series of deafening salvos, as President Gustav Husák took his place on the Tribune of Honour at Prague's packed Strahov Stadium. The gates opened and thousands of young gymnasts began to stream onto the field. The radio commentator waxed lyrical.
Za vlajkonoší kráčejí dívky v sněhobílých trikotech a volných prodloužených bílých sukních. V náručí kytice rudých květů.
The standard bearers are followed by girls in snow-white leotards and free-flowing long skirts, each bearing a bouquet of red flowers. Girls as beautiful as brides, so graceful that the goddesses of ancient Greece guarding the sacred Olympic flame would have envied them.
S půvabem, který by jí mohli závidět starořecké bohyně, strážkyně posvátného olympijského
ohně. For months, tens of thousands of people of all generations had been getting ready for the event, practicing songs and synchronized gymnastics.
Ano, levá, pravá, zpívají si ty malí žiačikova, či děťurenci z materských...
Yes, left, right, sing the little children. Over 117,000 children from 4 to 8 years old and hailing from all ends of the Republic have been practicing this song. They wouldn't all fit into the stadium, so we have just 3,840 children from in and around Prague here. And they're all marching beautifully in time, in neat rows of four, with their comrade teachers beside them in yellow tops and little white skirts. The event went on for several days, during which Prague virtually ground to a halt. The next Spartakiada was in 1985, and preparations were well underway for another one in 1990, an event that was hastily cancelled with the fall of communism. In January 1990, the Sokol movement, which for 40 years had been banned in Czechoslovakia, was once again made legal, and today it has nearly 200,000 members in the Czech Republic. Sokol organisations around the world continue to organise displays of calisthenics.
That was David Vaughan with From the Archives, wrapping up Radio Prague's English programme for today. If you'd like to listen again or recommend the programme to others, we are always on the internet for you. Simply turn to our website at radio.cz/en. We are always happy to discuss your questions and comments. You can write to us at any time by email at english@radio.cz, on Facebook or Twitter under Radio Prague, or of course with a good old-fashioned letter to Vinohradská 12, 12099 Prague. From me, Christian Falvey, thanks for listening and Naschledanou.